All right, buckle up, everybody, because we are diving deep today.
Oh, yeah.
We're tackling a question that has puzzled theologians for centuries. Like, what did Jesus really think about the Old Testament law? We're going to be exploring lecture 5 of Dr. Bill Mounce's series on the Sermon on the Mount, and I think you're going to be surprised by some of the answers.
Yeah, it is a fascinating topic because right from the start of Jesus' ministry, people were just like buzzing about like what was his stance on the law? You can just imagine those early Jewish leaders like huddled together whispering like, is this guy going to uphold our traditions or is he going to like totally overturn everything?
And Jesus, never one to shy away from a tough question, tackles it head on in Matthew 5:17. He says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." But here's the thing, like, what does fulfill actually mean?
Right. That's like the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
But Dr. Mounce breaks down this concept of fulfillment into a few different categories. And some are easier to grasp than others, I think.
Okay, let's start with the easy ones. What about Jesus fulfilling Old Testament prophecies? That seems pretty straightforward.
Right. Classic example, Jesus being born in Bethlehem. That directly fulfills Micah 5:2, which prophesied that the Messiah would be born in that very town.
Okay, so prophecy check. But what about all those Old Testament laws about sacrifices? Animal sacrifices were a huge part of Jewish life back then. How does Jesus fulfill that?
Yeah, well, this is where things start to get, I think, a little more radical, right?
Right.
Dr. Mounce argues that Jesus's death on the cross completely revolutionized our relationship with God. Like, no more need for all those, like, elaborate rituals and sacrifices in the temple.
Right, so no more altars, no more burnt offerings.
No more. Dr. Mounce says that Jesus fulfills the meaning behind those sacrifices. So in Leviticus, all those rituals were pointing to these core ideas, like God's holiness, the seriousness of sin, and God's mercy and offering like a substitute to take the punishment that we deserve. And so Jesus, through his sacrifice, becomes that substitute. He embodies all those concepts in a way that no animal sacrifice ever could.
Wow. Okay. That's a pretty huge shift. It kind of makes you wonder what else Jesus might have reinterpreted. What about those Jewish dietary laws, the whole kosher thing? I mean, did Jesus still keep kosher?
That's a great question. Dr. Mounce points to Mark 7, where Jesus says, it's not what goes into a person that defiles them, but what comes out. So the whole concept of clean and unclean gets flipped on its head. It's no longer about the food itself, but about what's in your heart.
So if it's not about the food anymore, what does it mean to be clean or unclean, according to Jesus? That seems like a pretty big deal.
Right. It becomes about inner purity, right? Rather than just like following external rules about what you eat.
Okay, this is fascinating. So we've got prophecy, sacrifices, and dietary laws. What other categories of fulfillment does Dr. Mounce talk about?
Well, he also talks about Jesus fulfilling the law through his perfect obedience.
Okay.
So he lived a life completely in line with God's will, which earned him a righteousness that surpasses anything we could achieve on our own.
So if Jesus fulfilled the law through perfect obedience, does that mean that we are off the hook? What does that mean for our pursuit of righteousness?
That is a great question.
Yeah.
And one we'll need to keep wrestling with for sure. But there's another layer to this whole fulfillment thing.
Okay.
Dr. Mounce argues that the entire Old Testament is ultimately about revealing God's character and will. And because Jesus is the perfect representation of God, he essentially fulfills the purpose of the Old Testament in this really profound way.
So it's not just about specific laws and prophecies being like ticked off a list. It's about this bigger picture of who God is and what he's doing in the world.
Exactly. Exactly. But that's not to say that those specific laws and prophecies don't matter.
Right. In fact, Jesus doubles down on their significance in Matthew 5:18.
That's where he says, not even the smallest letter of the law will disappear until everything is accomplished. It's like he's saying every single detail matters.
Exactly. And that's where things get really interesting.
Okay.
Dr. Mounce connects this to the idea of how the Bible was inspired. Like, how did those words actually get on the page?
Right. Because if even the tiniest details matter, that has huge implications for how we understand the whole Bible. This gets into the whole debate about how the Bible was inspired. Dr. Mounce subscribes to what's called verbal plenary inspiration, meaning that every single word in the Bible is directly from God and therefore true. He even has this kind of funny story about how his grad school buddies convinced him of this.
He does. He does. He talks about how they challenged his views and just insisted on the complete truthfulness of every word of Scripture. It seems like their commitment to, as Jesus puts it, every jot and tittle ultimately influenced his own understanding of biblical inspiration. Okay, so Jesus affirms the enduring significance of the law down to the smallest details, but then he drops this bombshell in Matthew 5:20. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven.
Oh, man, this has been shocking to his audience.
Right.
The Pharisees were known for their meticulous observance of the law. So for Jesus to say that even their righteousness wasn't enough, well, that's a major statement.
Okay, now things are getting really interesting. It seems like Jesus is completely reframing how we understand righteousness.
He absolutely is. And that's where we'll pick things up in part two of our deep dive. Stay tuned as we explore how Jesus redefines righteousness in the rest of the Sermon on the Mount.
Okay, so we're back, and things just got real. Jesus basically told the most religious people of his time that their righteousness isn't good enough. What happens next?
Well, he doesn't leave them just hanging there. He spends the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, like, laying out what true righteousness looks like. And let me tell you, it's pretty revolutionary.
Okay, so before we kind of dive into specifics, Dr. Mounts really emphasizes the importance of understanding the historical context of the Sermon on the Mount. Why is that so important?
Yeah, it helps us to see that Jesus isn't just delivering a random collection of, like, moral teachings, right? The Sermon on the Mount is a very deliberate, even radical reinterpretation of the law spoken against this very specific backdrop.
So paint the picture for us. What was going on in the world when Jesus delivered this sermon?
Okay, imagine this. It's early in Jesus' ministry. Crowds are flocking to him. And you know the Jewish people have been living under Roman occupation for decades. Their hopes for a political Messiah are growing stronger by the day. And they're looking for someone to overthrow their oppressors and restore Israel to its former glory.
So there's this intense longing for liberation, for a political revolution.
Exactly, exactly. But Jesus isn't about to lead a military uprising. He's launching a different kind of revolution, a kingdom revolution.
Yeah.
And the Sermon on the Mount is kind of like his manifesto, his declaration of what life looks like in God's upside-down kingdom.
Oh, I love that phrase, upside-down kingdom. It totally captures the feeling that Jesus is turning conventional wisdom on its head.
Yeah, precisely. He's challenging the status quo,
yeah,
including how people understood and interpreted the law.
And he's doing it with this quiet authority that must have been both compelling and kind of unsettling for those listening.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. You can almost like hear the gasps from the crowd as he starts unpacking what true righteousness looks,
yeah,
like. And that's where we get to those famous antitheses. You know, those six pronouncements where Jesus says, "You have heard it said, but I tell you."
Yes, the antitheses. This is where things get really specific. It's like Jesus is taking these well-worn paths of religious observance and just blazing a completely new trail through them.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
Yeah.
And he does it with such incredible skill. For example, he starts with anger. "You have heard it said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment."
Whoa. So it's not enough to just like simply avoid killing someone. Jesus is going deeper to the heart of the matter, addressing the root of the problem, anger itself.
Exactly. Exactly. He's exposing the hypocrisy of this outward obedience that masks inward resentment and rage. True righteousness, he's saying, goes far beyond just following the rules. It requires a transformation of the heart.
And he keeps doing this, going deeper and deeper with each antithesis, like with adultery. He says, "You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart."
Right. Again, he's taking it a step further. It's not just about avoiding the physical act of adultery. It's about conquering the desire, the lustful gaze that objectifies and dehumanizes another person. Jesus is calling for purity of heart, not just purity of action.
It's so radical, and it gets even more intense when he talks about divorce. He says, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery."
Oh, man, this was a bombshell in Jesus's day. Mm. Divorce was relatively common back then, so Jesus's words were directly challenging the prevailing social norms. He was saying that marriage isn't just a contract you can break whenever you feel like it. It's a sacred covenant rooted in God's design.
That's a pretty high standard, but it shows just how seriously Jesus took marriage. And speaking of high standards, let's not forget his teaching on oaths. He says, "Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all."
Right. It's like he's saying, just be honest, let your yes be yes and your no be no. You shouldn't need to swear on something to prove you're telling the truth. Your word should be good enough.
Yeah. It's about cultivating a life of such integrity that your word is your bond.
Exactly. And then there's the whole issue of retaliation. Remember that famous line, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? Well, Jesus flips that on its head too. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also.
Talk about taking the high road. This must have blown people's minds. It went against every natural instinct for self-defense and justice.
It did. It did. It was just a radical call for nonviolent resistance, a complete departure from the eye for an eye mentality. Jesus is saying, don't stoop to their level. Break the cycle of violence with love.
That's such a powerful message, especially in a world so obsessed with revenge and retribution. And then we come to what might be the most challenging antithesis of all: loving your enemies. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you.
This cuts to the very core of what it means to follow Jesus, right? It's a call to a love that transcends all boundaries, a love that extends even to those who want to hurt us.
It's a love that is utterly countercultural, a love that reflects the very heart of God. And that, I think, is the point of all the antitheses. Jesus isn't just giving us like a new set of rules. He's revealing a whole new way of being.
Yes, he's inviting us to participate in this radical, transformative work of his kingdom, a kingdom where love, grace, and mercy reign supreme.
So it's not about outward conformity. It's about inward transformation, about a heart that's truly aligned with God's heart.
You got it. But I got to admit, listening to all of this, it kind of makes me think, okay, this is all great in theory, but how on earth do I actually do it?
Right. It's easy to get overwhelmed by the sheer magnitude of what Jesus is calling for.
I know, right? Thankfully, that's where the second half of the Sermon on the Mount comes in.
Mm.
Jesus gets into the nitty-gritty of how we can actually live out these radical teachings.
Okay, so it's not just about lofty ideals. He actually gives us some practical advice.
He does. And one of the most important things he addresses is this question of motivation. You know, why do we do the things we do? What's driving our actions?
So it's not just what you do, but why you do it.
Exactly, exactly. And he tackles this head-on in his teachings on giving to the needy, praying, and fasting.
Oh, I remember those passages. He really warns against doing those things for the wrong reasons, like just to show off or impress people.
Yeah, like when he says, not to sound a trumpet when you give to the poor. Don't make a spectacle of your good deeds. Let your actions flow from a genuine desire to love and serve others, not from a desire for recognition or praise.
And it's the same with prayer, right? Don't pray on street corners just to be seen by others. Go into your room, shut the door, and pray to your Father in secret.
Precisely. It's about authenticity, aligning your inward motivations with your outward actions.
And then there's fasting. Don't make a big show of your fasting with a gloomy face and ashes on your head. Do it secretly, and your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you.
Exactly. It's not about earning brownie points with God or impressing other people with your piety. It's about cultivating a heart that is genuinely devoted to God, seeking his will above all else.
Wow. So this idea of having the right motivation, the right heart posture, is key to living out the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount.
Absolutely. And this emphasis on right motivation carries over into Jesus' teaching on treasures. Remember when he says, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Powerful words. It's like he's asking, what are you investing in? Where are you placing your ultimate hope and security?
Exactly. Yeah. He's calling us to reorient our priorities, to shift our focus from the temporary things of this world to the eternal realities of God's kingdom.
Because if we're constantly chasing after material wealth, status, or approval, then that's where our hearts will be, right?
Right. And Jesus makes it clear that you can't serve two masters. You can't be devoted to both God and money. You have to choose where your ultimate allegiance lies.
That's a sobering challenge, especially in a culture that's constantly telling us what to buy, achieve, and aspire to.
It is. But Jesus offers a different path, a path that leads to true fulfillment and lasting joy. It requires letting go of selfish ambition and embracing the values of his kingdom.
This is so much to unpack, but I'm curious, what else does Jesus say about how to actually live this out?
Well, he also talks about worry, something I think we can all relate to. He says, therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body what you will wear? Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life?
It seems like Jesus is saying that worry is not only pointless, but also a sign of misplaced trust.
You got it. He's inviting us to trust in God's provision, to believe that he cares for us even more than he cares for the birds of the air.
So it's a call to surrender our anxieties to a God who is bigger than our circumstances, a God who holds our lives in his hands.
Exactly. And then he gives this really powerful image of seeking first God's kingdom.
Mm.
But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. It's like he's saying, focus on what truly matters, and everything else will fall into place.
It's a reminder that when we align ourselves with God's will, when we make his kingdom our top priority, he takes care of the rest.
Precisely. And this is the heart of what it means to live out the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount. It's about surrendering our lives to God, trusting in his provision, and making his kingdom our primary pursuit.
Okay, I'm starting to get a clearer picture of what this surpassing righteousness looks like. It's not about blindly following rules. It's about this internal transformation that results in a life of love, grace, and radical obedience to God's will.
You've got it. And remember, this transformation is a journey, a process of continually aligning our hearts with God's heart.
It's a journey that requires humility, surrender, and a willingness to be shaped by the Holy Spirit.
Absolutely. And it's a journey that leads to a life of true freedom and joy, a life that reflects the beauty and power of God's upside-down kingdom.
Wow. This deep dive has been challenging and encouraging. It's like Jesus is holding up a mirror to my heart and showing me all the places I fall short.
I think that's the point of the Sermon on the Mount, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's meant to convict us, challenge us, and ultimately point us to the one who embodies true righteousness.
Yes. It's a reminder that we can't achieve this kind of surpassing righteousness on our own. We need God's grace, mercy, and the transforming power of his Spirit.
Beautifully put. And that's probably the most important takeaway from our deep dive into the Sermon on the Mount. It's not about striving for perfection, but surrendering to the one who is perfect and letting him work in us.
All right, we're back for the final part of our deep dive into the Sermon on the Mount. And I have to say, this whole conversation has really challenged me to think differently about what it means to follow Jesus.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenging text. But remember, Jesus doesn't just give us these like radical teachings and then leave us to figure it all out on our own, right? He actually offers some really practical advice on how to live them out.
Oh, good. Because I was starting to feel a little overwhelmed, like, okay, great, Jesus, but how am I supposed to love my enemies and not worry about anything? It all sounds great in theory, but like, what does it look like in practice?
Right. Well, that's where the second half of the Sermon on the Mount gets really interesting. Jesus gets into the nitty-gritty of how we can actually put these principles into action.
So what kind of practical advice does he give?
Well, he spends a good amount of time talking about how to handle conflict and disagreements.
Oh.
He says, if your brother or sister sins against you, go and point out their fault. Just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have won them over. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
If they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector.
Wow, that's pretty intense. It sounds like Jesus takes conflict and reconciliation seriously. But what does treating someone like a pagan or a tax collector actually look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, remember that in Jesus's day, pagans and tax collectors were considered outsiders, people who were shunned by the religious establishment. But Jesus consistently reached out to these marginalized groups, showing them compassion and inviting them into a relationship with God.
So maybe it's not about cutting people off or rejecting them, but continuing to love them and pray for them, even when they're difficult to deal with.
Exactly. It's about holding people accountable while still extending grace and seeking restoration.
Okay, so we've got some practical advice on conflict resolution. What else does Jesus talk about?
Well, he also gives some really challenging teachings about judging others.
Oh, yeah.
He says, do not judge, or you too will be judged. For the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you.
Ouch. That one hits close to home. I think we're all guilty of judging others sometimes, whether consciously or unconsciously. What's the takeaway here?
I think Jesus is calling us to this radical level of humility and self-awareness. Like, we need to be careful about pointing fingers at others when we have our own issues to deal with.
Yeah, it's like that saying, take the log out of your own eye before you try to take the speck out of your brother's eye.
Exactly. Jesus goes on to say, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. It's this powerful call to deal with our own shortcomings before we try to, like, fix other people.
So, self-reflection before correction.
Yeah, exactly. And then Jesus gives us this famous teaching about asking, seeking, and knocking.
Oh, yeah.
He says, ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And to the one who knocks, the door will be opened.
That's a passage that's quoted often, but I'm not sure I fully understand what it means. Is Jesus saying that we can get anything we want if we just ask for it?
Yeah, that's a common misunderstanding, I think. You know, I think it's less about getting specific things and more about seeking God with this persistence and wholeheartedness.
So it's about aligning our desires with God's will and trusting that He will provide what we need, even if it's not exactly what we asked for.
Exactly, yeah. And it's about trusting that God wants to reveal Himself to us, that He wants us to experience His love and grace.
Wow, this is so much deeper than I realized. Okay, so as we wrap up our deep dive into the Sermon on the Mount, is there one key takeaway you would like to leave our listeners with?
You know, I think the biggest takeaway is that the Sermon on the Mount is not just a list of rules or a set of impossible standards.
Yeah.
You know, it's an invitation to experience the transformative power of God's kingdom, a kingdom that is built on love, grace, and mercy.
And it's an invitation that requires us to surrender our own selfish ambitions and embrace the radical way of Jesus.
Exactly. It's a journey of continually aligning our hearts with God's heart and allowing His Spirit to work in and through us.
Wow, what a journey it is. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Sermon on the Mount. We hope it's challenged and inspired you to seek that surpassing righteousness that Jesus calls us to. Until next time, keep diving deep.